Beyond Governance, Making Sense of Doing Business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom line implications. At Plus 94 Research, we help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
A very good morning to you and welcome to it. This is your favorite show here at 101.9 High FM, show that is brought to you compliments of Plus 94 Research. My name is Imrat Upambele. I'm always delighted to share this space and time with you as we continue to shine spotlights on pertinent current affairs issues through the prisms of our esteemed guests. As we approach much anticipated national and provincial elections, it's only proper that we sharpen our insight so that we pierce through the rhetoric that is often sold by politicians. Interestingly, South Africa is not only the country going to polls this year. We will be joining about 64 countries around the globe, which include Russian Federation, the UK, Singapore, Mexico, and the largest democracy, which is India, and obviously followed by the US. And in this year's elections, these 69 plus countries represent a whopping 49% of the people around the globe. You can imagine how massive that is in terms of the policy that will be coming. And here in South Africa, our elections will be contested by over 200 political parties. 200 political parties in a country that's small as ours. Your take to it will be interesting. And the majority of these political parties are hardly known, and yet they are wooing you and I to vote for them through their political manifestos. And these are some of the issues that we need to look into. The substantiveness of the political manifesto, beyond just a piece of paper, it is about the leadership, people who are behind those particular manifestos, the extent to which they are credible, the extent to which they have integrity, the extent to which they're worth the salt, so to speak. Anyway, before we get into our gist of conversation regarding the election manifestos, allow me to express my gratitude to the Morning Mayhem team under the stewardship of Howard Feldman, and I'm sure he's kept you captivated, intrigued as he often does, and they'll definitely be back on your radio tomorrow at the same time. As we proceed, I want to thank the team behind the show, Craig Guthrie, who is on the controller, last but not least, Harry Seleke, who is the producer of the show. The gentlemen make the ship cruise, you know, much to the delight of you, the listener. Moving along, if you missed any of our previous shows, not to worry. Simply go to our website, download the podcast, and share your views with us. As indicated earlier, we will continue probing more the political manifestos as the country is gearing to the national and provincial elections on the 29th of May. And it is also very important. It's very important for us to reflect on the actual meaning of these manifestos, just beyond what has been articulated on a piece of paper, because there's a huge difference between what is stated and what actually happens in reality. We are in a mess economic-wise. We are fractured as a society. Race relations are obviously at the highest, purely because there's been a failure to translate several manifestos into practical realities so that it benefits you and I. As we continue on this particular trajectory on political manifesto probing, in terms of what it means for you and I as we gear ourselves for elections on the 29th of May, I'm joined by Herman Pretorius, who is the head of strategic communication at the Institute of Race Relations, as well as Sandy Leswana, who is the governance expert and political analyst. Gentlemen, without any waste of time, thank you very much for coming through.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning to you, Dr. Mbele. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, as we set the scene, we have had a number of political parties unleashing their very fancy political manifestos. And we've had the Rising Zansi, Action SA, EFF, Patriotic Alliance, and so on and so forth. And of course, over the weekend, everybody knows that ANC unveiled its political manifesto. Firstly, as we start, we have a serious problem of vote apathy in this country. And all the 200 plus political parties seems to try and to capture the vote apathy that runs into the last time I checked out close to 12 to 13 million people who are just less interested. How, first and foremost, why is the vote apathy so huge in this country? And what is the best mechanic to address it? Let me have Sandile, you're welcome to the first part of that particular question.
The voter apathy in South Africa, I would compare it to, you know, you can look at it from the perspective of a sports league, let's say a soccer league. In South Africa, you measure the interest in soccer with a derby, the Soweto derby. If the standard of soccer among the top two teams, especially the top four teams, is high, interest of spectators is there. When the competition is intense and the standard is very high across the teams, it attracts spectators. The unfortunate circumstance that we face in South Africa, especially since the Polokwane Conference of the African National Congress, is that the two biggest parties, which is the DA and the ANC, have been losing popular support. And this popular support is linked to mediocre performance. And an illustration of the mediocre performance would be that in all the metros of South Africa, regardless of who's running that metro, none of them has achieved the stipulated 5.4% GDP growth per annum. Stipulated in the NDP, none of them has achieved the 6% GDP growth per annum stipulated in the African Union Agenda 2063. Instead, and also, when you look at how they've dealt with, whether it's a province, a metro, and the nation as a whole, very recently you've seen them boasting, some of them, such as the DA, boasting that they have the lowest unemployment rate in South Africa, around 20% in the Western Cape. But when you compare them to their mentors, such as the United States, which is 3.7 unemployment rate, compare them to their other mentor, Germany, is 5%. So they are a mediocre comparing itself to another mediocre, the ANC. It's like having students. One has achieved 10%, another one has achieved 5%, and the pass mark is 50%. And the one who has 10% is busy posting that is very successful. So these are dull, ineffectual major parties in South Africa that have not shown us the sparks. There is no brilliance at all. And that has caused voter apathy in the sense that people are not getting physically what they are supposed to get from either party.
Interesting observation indeed. Hamen, your take on it, Sonile made very interesting observation around performance, which he defined as very mediocre. Your take on it?
I think I have to partly agree with Sandile. I think the soccer analogy is apt in the sense that when there's a particular quality at play, then there's interest. So I think that is quite correct. Where I do think I disagree from Sandile is on a few points. One is, I think factually, the ANC have been losing electoral support since its highlight or since its high watermark of 2004, when it essentially got 70% of the vote under Mbeki's leadership. And then for every election after that, it has gone backwards. Where the DA have gone backwards in two elections. They lost national support in 2019, going from about 22% to just above 20%. And then they, in relation to a previous election cycle, lost support in the 2021 local government elections compared to their high watermark of about 27-28% in the 2016 municipal elections. But the opinion polls that we look at, whether they are from the Institute of Race Relations, the Brenthurst Foundation, the ANC's own internal polls, the DA's internal polls, what we do see is a continuing decline of ANC support, but a recovery of DA support back to the mid-20s. So while I do think that the ANC are in trouble with a decline in their support, and while the DA certainly have had a tough election cycle from 2016, their high watermark, and 2019 and 2021 not being so good for them, where they they went backwards in their support. I don't think it's quite right to make the claim that both the ANC and the DA are on a downward trajectory. Data, the opinion polls certainly don't seem to indicate that, nor do the registration numbers, where we saw that the DA performed relatively well in the logistics of getting their supporters to register over the two registration weekends that the IEC organized. Then to look at the records of governance, I don't think it is quite right to compare the DA's performance to the United States and Germany, when the national political and policy landscape that determine the socioeconomic framework within South Africa is controlled by the ANC. Now, the problem with South Africa's governmental system is that it's actually annoyingly complex, and not everyone is clear on what local government powers are, what provincial government powers are, and what national government powers are. But what is clear is that when investors look at South Africa, they consider, first and foremost, the national policy climate. So we see the same happening in Zambia, Rwanda, Uganda, where national governments are trusted on investments and market sentiment. Regional governments get the benefit of that. Where those national governments are not trusted, regional governments suffer below. So whilst the DA is right in saying that they have the lowest unemployment numbers in South Africa, I think everyone would agree that even if it is 20%, it is still too high.
On that note, if I could just quickly interject, Herman, let's take a break. We'll come back because you have raised interesting points that you question or perhaps maybe contest the claims made by Sandile here. Let's take a break. We'll come back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post-94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research. The science of decision making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I am joined by Herman Pretorius, who is the communication strategic communication at the Institute of Race Relations, as well as Sandile Zwane, a political analyst and governance expert. We are probing the political manifestos that have been ushered by various political parties, as we all know that we are heading for national polls on the 29th of May. I want to bring in Sandile here because Herman raised a number of issues. First and foremost, you agree on the soccer metaphor, but you simply say it's not possible that the decline of ANC could be linked or could be the same as that of the DA. Any of you, the DA is a better performer, even though by Sandile's standards, that remains mediocre and so on and so forth. Your take on that, Sandile, because the question was, why are we not able to attract 16 million plus South Africans who have simply said, we have no trust in politicians, we don't want to vote, there's no vain in voting, despite the fact that millions of people died for this freedom?
Before I go back to elaborate on my answer, let me just maybe make one or two points. One being that polls differ from the results that are recorded at the IEC. For instance, if a player is very competent during training, but during matches doesn't show the same competence in the actual matches, what goes into the historical statistics of that player and his career is what he actually scores in the actual matches, no matter how good he is at practice. So the I would compare the surveys, that is talk about the polls, to just a match practice there out in the field, not in Orlando Stadium or FNB or Loftus First Field or anything like that. Nevertheless, one of the people who's been chasing these matters for a very long time, and he worked at Visa, I suspect he's still around there, his name is David Everett. Now, David Everett, on the 5th of February, published, and it's on the Vits website, Vits University website, one of the surveys. In that survey, I suppose we have license to quote any survey. In that survey, the Western Cape, for instance, what is predicted is that the DA will get 42% in this particular survey. Obviously, it's less in every other province. Even when you quote surveys, you can't quote these ones that favor your opinion. You must also quote these ones, like this one, for instance.
Nimrod, let me come in there just very quickly. David Everett makes a methodological error in his analysis in that survey. So number one, I wouldn't say that polling results are the same as election results. But what I would say is that they are an indicator of trends. And I'm not saying that the polls are the same as results. But even if you include by-election results, you do not see the same type of voter rejection with the DA than you see at the ANC. And number two, on the point of David Everett's survey, he includes the don't knows in the survey considered, and that's what pushes the DA support below 50%. The moment the don't knows are excluded from the final tally, as is the usual methodology in opinion polling, the DA goes up to above 50% in the Western Cape. So on the one hand, we shouldn't make polls equal to the result. And I'm not doing that. But I am saying they are indicators of the direction of travel. But then when we use polls, we must use them correctly. And unfortunately, the Everett interpretation is methodologically unsound.
Interesting point. But nevertheless, let's give Sandile an opportunity to conclude his argument based on what you define as methodologically unsound research by David Everett, which I know very well. Please proceed.
Yeah. There are other articles during the month of February, you'll kind of remember it was the 16th of February, where it says the Patriotic Alliance snatched a George Ward from the DA with an overwhelming victory in this weekend's by-election. So now what we are noticing over the past few weeks in February was that both the ANC and the DA in Western Cape and in KZN actually lost ground. Those are numbers that are recorded at the IEC, recent numbers in February. So, therefore, I'll just make that available to the public. Now, I want to say about the lack of interest of the voters. I was actually stunned by a veteran of the ANC one time, when I published on Facebook the idea that the entire process of struggle for liberation needed to produce tangible benefits in the uplifting of the living standards and the quality of life of people. And he was stunned and almost rebuked me in saying that the outcome of the struggle could be measured, could be material in nature. And I think this is the mistake the two biggest parties are making, and therefore causing voters, especially the youth, to lose interest in elections, where the living conditions, including malnutrition, lack of food, lack of basic necessities at home, and lack of financial independence in black homesteads, particularly in the Western Cape and in South Africa as a whole and in all the municipalities that are governed by the ANC, as well as the DA, including places like Tshwane, where black people have got uncontrolled sewerage running all over the show. In other places, we've got businesses being disinvesting in certain towns and running to other towns and so on and so forth, where tangibly people have seen, for instance, where I spend a lot of my time in the area of Umtata, where factories have actually just closed down, huge successful agricultural enterprises have closed down, and therefore there is no food on the table. Now, that has caused people to de-link. Every time you elect the DA or the ANC, you don't see a better life, better quality of life, and a higher standard of living. And that has caused a decline of both political parties.
As we proceed on this agenda, the bullseye is transformation, the extent to which any political party grapples or seeks to grapple with transformation agenda, which would bring about social equity, which would bring about social justice. Two principles that for now have not been seen or been realized. It's social equity, poverty still have a black face, and it's also about social justice. So all the political parties claim to have a grasp or a position on transformation of the country to a point where we are equitable, we are progressive, we are wealthy, and as a matter of fact, we are, you know, the fortunes are dwindling on a day-to-day basis. What is your bullseye from your end, Herman? Why is it that all these political parties, the DA, the ANC, the EFF, and so on and so forth, aren't necessarily making sufficient grounds in transforming the economy as enshrined in the Constitution to a point where it is a prison that represents the overwhelming majority?
So I think we're veering on the verge of immensely shallow analysis by simply ignoring some crucial facts here. Number one, between 1996 and 2007, there were significant strides made in the quality of life in South Africa under an ANC government. Access to housing, access to water, access to electricity, access to education, all improved during those first 10 years. The number of people, especially black South Africans, in formal employment doubled between 1998 and 2008. So when there are questions about whether the transformation from apartheid to democracy can be materially felt, that is an absolutely true claim. But then the second part of the analysis must show those positive trajectories have stalled at a national basis and, in fact, over the last 5 years have reversed. Access to housing, electricity, these things have started going down again. So number one, it's very important that when we talk about where progress has been made, we actually look at the facts. Number two, the DA is not the sole governing party in Tswane, as Sandile very well knows. Between 2016 and 2021, there was a confidence and supply arrangement that gave a temporary vote-by-vote majority for the DA-led coalition. Then there was an illegal, as declared by the courts, administration of Tswane that transformed a 260 million surplus into a 4 billion deficit. That is what is currently happening in the city here. Then we should also consider the fact that in the by-election that Sandile refers to in KwaZulu-Natal, where he says the DA has gone backwards, he ignores the fact that the DA and the IFP have an agreement not to contest seats against each other. That was a by-election in which the DA did not contest the seat, allowing the IFP to win it quite comfortably. So when we look at the fact whether there are socioeconomic indicators and whether there are political indicators, we must be honest here. And when it comes to the question of transformation, the question of transformation is a complex one and we should treat it with due respect. But the data shows that as early as 2015, the South African middle class was mostly black and not white. And of course, there's still a lot of progress to be made there. But the clincher of transformation for me in South Africa is that the highest inequality gap is between the richest black South Africans and the poorest black South Africans, not between white and black South Africans. The richest black South Africans, those whom Moletsi Mbeki call rent seekers and the architect of poverty, have gained connection and influence, undue economic power through non-value add policies like BEE that have only benefited around 15% of the black population in South Africa. 85% of the black population in South Africa have not benefited from BEE. So when we look at the question of transformation, let's listen to the people when they say to us in the opinion polls that Sandile might disparage, but that have proved accurate in every election cycle and over 15 years, the question that the IRR put to South Africans is whether they need, what would be the best route to transformation? And the answer by more than 70% of black and all South Africans is better education and more jobs will be the route to end racial inequality. So I agree with the point about transformation, but you don't achieve transformation by doubling down on failed policies. We have 20 years of BEE to look back on. We can see black unemployment today is higher than 20 years ago. Youth unemployment is higher than it was 20 years ago. Corruption is worse than it was 20 years ago. Productivity is lower than it was 20 years ago. So when we talk about transformation, we must take it seriously enough not to let bad policy off the hook and and say we are so serious about transformation that we will get it right.
And I want to bring in Sandile here on the FAIL policies. I mean, you made reference to how the BE has been defined as a non-value add, for it has only benefited a minority of blacks or black elites. That is factually correct. But does that mean the policy in its architecture, the policy in its intent, was misconceived? I want to, you know, hear Sandile's on that particular point, because I draw a huge disjuncture between declaration and application. If the application is false, if the application is misguided, if the application has been stolen by thieves, does it make it unacceptable? Does it make it undesirable in terms of the intent, which is linked to what the Constitution seeks to achieve on the issue of equity and equality? Sandile, your take on that?
First of all, just let's get something out of the way. The idea of transformation in any nation, the idea of speeding up the rate at which anybody can get out of poverty in any nation, whether you are in France, in the United States, in Sweden, anywhere, is measured, and people always try to find ways of removing all obstacles to say, if a person is born in this country, how quickly can they get out of poverty? And families get into poverty for different reasons. Some were rich and fall into poverty. Some have been rich, poor for a long time, and so on. But the policy of government must be able to say, in any country, accelerate the movement out of poverty. Now, so I am then agreeing with a view that says transformation must always be there. Transformation in South Africa did not start with the ANC. Let me put it that way. The white Afrikaners in South Africa also started to believe in transformation and multinational corporations. And I'll make examples, and then I'll come to my point. Simple example is that, for instance, companies like Anglo-American started recruiting top black students in South Africa, and I was one of them. Dalimpof was another one, and many others, into their scholarship programs to develop them, and so on and so forth, because it had been recognized that black education, since before the introduction of Bantu education, was on par, actually, and at times ahead of white Afrikaner education in particular. And I refer to Professor William Hart of UCT for that, who wrote about that in 1964, and that is available in the von Mises website. So that book is available, 400 pages. Now, the problem that we have today, okay, let me make this point. Sorry, I forgot this. For instance, the Electricity for All program at Eskom was started around 1984-85 by the white administration. The introduction of black managers, specifically black men who had been excluded by the Job Reservation Act, was introduced around the same time. And many companies, including IBM, had already started in the mid-70s to introduce specific affirmative action programs to close the gap that had been intentionally created by job reservation and by Bantu education. Now, there are mistakes that have been made, and we have not had the white establishment, including the Institute of Race Relations, including the DA, the Freedom Front Plus, actually coming up with credible solutions. I'm quoting from the Business Day of 25 October 2017, where Badili Hutla was speaking. Badili Hutla says the percentage, bear in mind that the percentage in South Africa of graduates to the general population is about 6%, and it is one of the worst in the world. But the white population, the percentage of graduates in South Africa has actually improved throughout and is actually ahead of many European countries. But the percentage of black graduates, according to this quote from Badili Hutla here, which is in front of me, in 1975 was about 15% of black graduates to the general population, and has since declined to about 5%, and this was what he said in 1970. So one of the bases of transformation could have been to say, we're going to treble the number of universities and technicons and what have you, and what have you, and make sure that black students have got skills, because black job market entrants have got the right skills. Because right now, even those people, black people who are unemployed in the unskilled category, because Africans in particular dominate that segment, and we've been getting de-educated in this period of independence. So from 1994, educationally, the rulership of the ANC and this democracy has been devastating to the African community by excluding us from the economy, and there is action needed to correct that in particular.
Let me just bring in Hammond here. You raise also a number of pertinent issues as to why transformation comes across as a tie around our neck, if you like. Hammond, your take on Sandile's views, which somehow are expressed in a wide number of political manifestos.
So, firstly, I think we must make the point that talking about terms like white establishment and seeking to include the IRR in that doesn't move the conversation forward in any case. The Institute of Race Relations is 100 years old. We've worked with literally from every political party under the sun, from the PAC to ASAPO to the Black Consciousness Movement, the Black Sash, the National Party, the ANC. We are not part of the quote-unquote white establishment. I don't know what the quote-unquote white establishment even is supposed to mean in a non-racial society. So frankly, let's get rid of those types of labels. I do agree with Sandile that there has been a deterioration in upskilling of South Africa's people. But something that we must also keep in mind, and speaking about publications that Sandile very helpfully cite, there's an incredible book called South Africa's War Against Capitalism, written by an African-American economist by the name of Walter E. Williams in the 1980s, where he attacked the apartheid government for being anti-economic growth. By implementing race-based policies, the apartheid government segmented the South African economy to such an extent that businesses couldn't employ people. Those people couldn't use employment as a ladder to be upskilled over time. And the economic segmentation by race class in South Africa also led to a relative poverty amongst white South Africans. So white South Africans did better economically after the first 10 years of democracy, the same as black South Africans, because in a free economy where people can use their talents and their time and their skills to go after economic opportunities and become problem solvers to earn an income through the delivery of goods or services, when you cannot access 90% of your population, as apartheid insisted, that shrinks your growth potential as a business. If you compare white South Africans over the 20th century with Canadians, with Australians, you will see that white South Africans, because of apartheid, were kept relatively poor to the potential that was illustrated in other countries. Of course, black South Africans did even worse because of the racism of apartheid and the exact economic exclusion that Sandile is rightly pointing to as still something that we struggle with today. The question that we then must ask ourselves is, the basics for economic growth are relatively simple. You need the opportunity to upskill, whether that's through education, apprenticeships, or TVET colleges, or even on the job training. Are we in a position where young South Africans have those opportunities? I don't think so. And that's a policy failure, the same policy failure that Sandile laments about the de-education of young black South Africans, which is an immensely tragic loss of human potential. The second thing you need for economic growth is the ability of businesses to get the goods and services they produce to market. So that means roads, rail, law and order. You have to be able to go out and sell your goods. And then the last thing you need is you need a consumer base that is able to, number one, earn an income and spend that income. If you don't have those three things in place, you won't get economic growth that will fuel constructive transformation. So the three problems we face are skills in South Africa. We've got a crisis there. We've got an infrastructure crisis where businesses cannot get their goods or services to market. And our consumer, whether they are white or black, whether they are poor or rich, are under immense pressure because their own resources are being drained in this national context of economic stagnation.
On that note, let's take a break and be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making. Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom line implications. At Plus 94 Research,
We help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. Thank you very much for joining, for staying tuned. We're having a very interesting conversation as we unpack the political manifestos put forward by different political parties. On this note, I am joined by Herman Pretorius, who is a strategic communication Institute of Race Relations, as well as Sandile Swane, the political analyst and governance expert. Gentlemen, as we proceed on this very complex and multi-layered issue, which all political parties are trying to wrestle around, which is mainly around transformation. And one of the issues that I wanted to take forward as we proceed on this glorious day is the ideologies presented by these political parties. To what extent are they in sync with their program? We all know that the EFF has got its own ideology, the DA has got its own ideology, the Freedom Front Plus has got its own ideology, and so on and so forth. And there are obviously contestations, and how these ideologies underpins design of the program in terms of how to take the country forward around the budget deficit that we've known about, around unemployment that is sitting at 40% when using a broader definition, and you know, the failing infrastructure, which we all know about, electricity, water, and the issues that Herman has correctly pointed out on the basis for economic growth, which is around skilling of the workforce and also ability to get the services to the market. And obviously can't do those particular issues if the infrastructure is ailing, if the infrastructure has broken. This is a point that Sandile also recognized, that a lot of movement in poorer communities where business are disinvesting purely because there is no energy, the road infrastructure is poor. So these are practical issues that all political parties seems to grapple with. But how do we take the conversation forward on the basis of some of this ideology? Because there again lie a big contestation. Sandile, your take on that?
Yeah, thank you so much, Nimrod. The issue of ideology, to my mind, is actually largely irrelevant, because what has actually happened in many disciplines of practice and study is that you now need evidence-based solutions, which means that, and that idea largely comes from the medical field. Where I come from, in amongst the Xhosa people in the Eastern Cape, there's a muti there that is called uzifozonke, which means it's a muti that regardless of what you are sick of, you take that muti. That is one of the most unscientific approaches to life, and dangerous actually. So in evidence-based solutions, you then say, in the cases that have happened, how many times has this muti cured this? And what were the results, what were the side effects and all that? And then you say, no, we now recommend that if a patient shows these symptoms, this must be the correct muti. And China has proved this, because they went to the IMF and the World Bank, and the economists of the World Bank and IMF were giving them solutions. And China would then take these solutions home, study them, study the culture, study the context, and re-engineer those solutions, come back with them to the IMF, and then they were told these things will never work. When they implemented them, they actually worked. So I am saying that we don't need to be worried about the socialist ideology of the EFF or this other ideology, whatever it is, of the DA and the ANC and all these things. We need to be able to say, is this solution evidence-based, evidence-led? Is there evidence that something like this can work in our cultural context, and so on and so forth? So that would be where I stand on that question. Secondly, the African National Congress, which has been ruling South Africa for a long time, I think at a certain point, certainly after the Polokwane conference, this is my judgment of the situation, that you cannot really talk about the ANC and ideology in one sentence, because the main program then in the ANC more especially, and we cannot talk about state capture and talk about systemic corruption in the ANC, which Mbeki talked about, and many of them, and Batabile Dlamini said, all of us have got small Lanyana skeletons. What that tells us is that the full-time program in the ANC was criminality. Not to think about policy, not to think about programs, not to do any research. So to talk about the ANC and to talk about the ideology and whether the ideology succeeded or failed is irrelevant, because they were not in that business. They were in the criminal, corruption and crime business. So that would be my take on that, that there's no one, the Freedom Front Plus, the EFF, no one worries me about their ideology, because the whole idea of designing government policy and designing programs and plans and budgets based on ideology, that has fallen by the wayside among the nations that believe in science.
Absolutely. Let me bring in Herman here, because the interesting point that you're putting forward is evidence. You're saying some of these political ideologies have to be consumed on a basis or discarded on a basis of evidence. Your take on that, Herman?
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree that policies that have been in place for 20 years that haven't delivered what they promised to deliver must be scrapped. That is why I'm against BEE. It is 20 years after BEE has become law, and we see that BEE has not uplifted black South Africans. In fact, it has taken the elite enrichment that was so prevalent under apartheid and has just given it another skin color, as Mletse Mbeki, I think, pointed out in 2009 already. I half agree with Sandile about ideology. I think where ideology does not matter is to the ordinary South African. To us political analysts and to philosophers and whatever, political ideology is interesting and useful. But to the ordinary South African, I don't believe the ordinary South African identifies themselves in the main as I'm a capitalist, I'm a socialist, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative. The ordinary South Africans just want things to get better. So from that perspective, I don't think voters vote for ideology. But if you look at the research, we can understand what voters vote for. Voters vote for a value proposition from a political party. To get to a value proposition, you need a message. You need communication. To get to communication, you need a message. To get to a message, you need actions. To get to actions, you need policies. And to get to policies, you need ideology. So ideology does form part of the production line of what gets a vote. But it isn't, at the end of the day, the thing that voters vote for. So to that extent, I agree. Ideology is less important now to the average South African than it used to be. But when it comes to evidence-based policy, we don't have to look too far. We can look at the years 1996 to 1997, when the policy that was primarily instituted and implemented by Mbeki and Trevor Manuel was one of market liberalization, fiscal discipline from government, and based on that fiscal discipline, the rollout of a social welfare support system. It was during those eras of surplus in the mid-2000s that the SASSA grant system was created, because economic growth fed into healthy revenue, and healthy revenue made it possible for the Treasury to afford a social welfare grant. Then what happened in 2007 was we went from the conservative fiscal responsibility and prudence of Trevor Manuel to the absolutely reckless spending of Pravin Gordhan, who within a decade of his taking office as Minister of Finance has ballooned our national deficit and our debt to such an extent that we are now on the verge of struggling to afford basic things like the SASSA grants that South Africans need as that final defense against poverty. And what you do with the money you get as government, whether you spend it or whether you save it, that is, at the end of the day, actually an ideological decision. Do we want to go to the ideology, whether we want to call it that or not, but perhaps we should call it something different, the fundamental belief. Should we go back to that where Mbeki and Manuel saw economic growth, unemployment was going down, the fiscus was in a healthy state, or should we look at the reckless era of government spending that we got under Pravin Gordhan?
Absolutely. Let's pause for on that particular point as we gravitate towards the end of this very interesting show. We'll be back in a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post-94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research. The science of decision making.
Thank you for staying tuned in. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Tembele. I am joined by Herman Pretorius, who is the Strategic Communications at the Institute of Race Relations, as well as Sandile Sane, who is the Political Analyst and Governance Expert. We are debunking political manifestos in a context of high voter apathy. We all know that majority of South Africans are languishing in poverty, and political parties are scrambling to load us in, and as far as our votes. But, you know, before we went to the break, Herman made a very interesting point around ideology, which I am struggling a bit. You're quite correct that somebody who's hungry does not need ideology. But unfortunately, ideology, that kind of language, is a forte of researchers, academics, and so on and so forth. But on the practical side, we have seen how coalitions have fractured. And given the fact that the polls and the practical experience of ordinary South Africans suggest that the ANC is likely to win just over around, just less than 50%, let's say so, which inevitably would lead us to some form of coalition. And the question for me is, for what would be the building block for sustained coalition, not the mess that you've seen? If the local government misgivings in Ekurhuleni, city of Johannesburg, and in the Eastern Cape is anything to go by, we are sitting in a fiscal mess that will further dampen the spirit already impoverished people. So let's go back to that particular point. What are some of the lessons that we are taking on the collapse of coalitions in local government, and how those can be avoided? Because the Moon Pact propagated by Action SA and others do obviously try and consolidate that, but in practice, those are some of the biggest challenges. Let me bring in Sandile on this particular point.
Thank you so much. I think that the issue of coalitions, first of all, everybody, including the DA and the ANC, must accept that coalitions are a reality, which means that South Africans have not chosen a specific political party to run a particular province or to run the nation. They basically want some form of a version of government, of national unity. Once you respect that and not want to be the anchor tenant of any coalition or to be the boss of any coalition, you realize that you have a constituency and you've come here to represent your constituency without bullying anybody. That will be a good start. The second thing relative to that, and it also links to the issues that Herman is raising, this one of, because we need to agree that we are elected to go and do something, and something that is constructive. Now, the issue of government expenditure is often misrepresented. I read a report from the African Development Bank, which financed the Medupi power station in the north, in the northern province, the Limpopo. Part of their justification for the investment was that this is one of the flagship projects in South Africa. And this flagship project is going to add 0.6%, more than 0.5% per year to the GDP of South Africa. Which then means that that money that is spent there is going to return that. Now imagine how many power stations, if you were to do such a calculations for the power stations in South Africa, and what that would do to our GDP and our income as a nation. So what has actually damaged South Africa is actually this habit of spending money on things that don't return anything. I am sure that, in fact, it is true that the 0.6% addition to the GDP was long forgotten, because criminality and other tendencies were added to the government expenditure. Not that the government expenditure itself was inherently wrong, but the idea of not tying a government expenditure to returns is the problem. And that is the type of thing that Badili Hutla has said, let's call a CODESA around this thing. What do we want to do, all of us, about this South Africa? Because we cannot be spending money without thinking about return on investment.
On that note, let me bring in Hamad here. The issue, obviously, is the inevitability of the coalition. That's something that, you know, the polls and practical and common sense do suggest. Your take on that in terms of strengthening those alliances, strengthening those coalition to betterment of what you and I as ordinary South Africans want from those that we elect to power.
So I think in this morning's conversation, one thing came out that genuinely could offer the route towards stable coalitions. And I'm in the process of doing a lot of research about coalitions. And we, as a brief aside, we must acknowledge that in South Africa, since 1994, there have been many more coalitions than Tswane, Ekurhuleni, and Joburg. And actually, most coalitions over the last 30 years have been relatively stable. So coalitions have gotten a very bad name because of some very prominent coalition failures. And that's understandable. A newspaper headline saying coalition stable isn't going to sell as much as a news headline saying coalition in chaos. So when it comes to coalitions, I think that the seed of a solution lies in what Sandile raised earlier in the evidence-based policy sphere. And when we talk about growth-orientated economic spending, what we're actually talking about is the fiscal multiplier principle. Now, the fiscal multiplier principle is quite simply that for every 1 rand that the government spends, 1 rand or more must be added to the GDP value of South Africa. That's when you know public spending is in a healthy position. The problem is in South Africa, if the IRR last week published a report, a very brilliant report by my colleague Gabriel Krauser, called Slash Waste Cut Taxes, in which he delves very deeply into the fiscal multiplier calculations in South Africa. And he shows that in South Africa, the fiscal multiplier is negative. For every rand the government spends, the economy actively loses GDP growth. So that is an indication that public spending is out of control and, as Sandile points out, is done badly. This is why at Transnet we have a 28-cent straw being paid 28 rand for, an inflation of the cost of 10,000%. So when we come to the question of solution, and again, I think the IRR has put forward solutions. I can't speak for everyone else. The basis of a new coalition in South Africa should be centered on something like the fiscal multiplier approach, where we say we can agree that for every rand we spend as a government, the economy must grow at least 1 rand and hopefully more. That is the sound, empiric, scientific almost basis of collaboration and hopefully coalition government stability and success.
Gentlemen, unfortunately, we have run out of time. We're going to have to leave it here. Thank you very much for giving us with your insight and wisdom on some of the very complex issues that find expressions in the political manifesto that have been put to us by different political parties.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There we go. That's an interesting observation and insights that have really sharpened our senses around who to go for as we head for polls on the 29th of May this year. We all know that South Africa is in a mess and we need men and women of stature to take us out of this fiscal mess that we find ourselves in. And those types of interesting sites that we presented potentially have a huge way of addressing unemployment, economic slowdown, and our reputation back in the global stature. Unfortunately, we're going to have liberty. We have run out of time. It has been absolutely beautiful. Thank you very much for tuning in. Shalom.